This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is the Hidden Killers Podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
We're going to dive more into the mind behind the crime on this edition of the program with Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author. And her new book is out, Nightbird. You can get it on Amazon or wherever you get books, or you can go request it from your local bookstore or wherever you want. It's very good. It's quite a story that you have to tell in this book. I've just begun getting into it, and I need more time in my day. But you also gave me the audiobook too. So you can get the audiobook out there as well, depending on what your schedule is like. But do check that out. Yeah. So there's a lot in this. We're not diagnosing Karen Reed. We can't do that. This is just speculation on a lot of different angles of what may be going on in this mind. Because I think once you kind of get an understanding of maybe what's going on behind those statements, behind those thoughts, behind those actions, you can kind of, it makes more sense. Let's start off with what happened, what this whole case is about. John O'Keefe being struck by a vehicle. The allegation is Karen Reed is the one that struck him. Vehicle is the one that says it struck him at the precise moment when his phone stopped working. So let's operate on the assumption that this actually did happen and that Karen, in fact, backed it up. The big question is, did she do it with rage, with a lot of passion because she was angry at John, or was this simply just an accident? She hit reverse and then she went in it and didn't realize that he was behind her and she was in her drunken stupor? Or is it some sort of a little mix of everything, hitting the gas really hard, but not really expecting that you're going to hit John because you're too oblivious to actually hit him? What it comes down to is possibly narcissistic injury and narcissistic rage. That's where people can really act out. Before we talk about what maybe going on in the mind of Karen, why don't you enlighten us on what that is, what narcissistic rage is, the type of folks who would have it, and why?
Well, narcissism is, of course, the person who thinks that they're better than other people, often better than everyone else. And so they expect special treatment. And when they don't receive special treatment, they can have very big reactions, and you know, that may be out of proportion to what would be typical for a person who doesn't have those personality traits. So that would be my quick summation of you know, what narcissistic rage would look like.
And when we're talking about big reactions, things that are bigger than just, I'm really mad at you, I'm going to send you a bunch of angry texts, or I'm going to send you a bunch of horrible voicemails, which she certainly did. And we're not saying she's a narcissist, but she certainly seems to have a lot of traits. So let's, in theory, say maybe she is, just in theory. Would it be at all surprising to you that if they were going through, from what we understand, kind of getting ready to break up, didn't seem like things were all that great between the two of them, although they didn't really demonstrate a lot of that at the Waterfall Bar and the other place they were at right before. But certainly internally they did. She's talked about them fighting. They've talked about, there's even been testimony that John had said, this seems like this thing has run its course. There's a lot of evidence there that points that John was really kind of getting ready to get out of this thing. Karen in interviews says, no, John says he'd never break up with me. Interesting. But let's talk about this. Would it be shocking if they got into a really big fight in that car? He got out. It's like, I'm done. I'm going to go to this party. Whatever was said, that one in that fit of rage would hit reverse and go 75% on the gas pedal, 26 miles an hour, 27 miles an hour, and end up hitting him. Is that out of the question for someone with that sort of rage?
Certainly not out of the question, but it would surprise me, because she, as we've talked about, she was in her professional life a high-functioning woman who obviously had good judgment and didn't act out in strange ways from anything that we've heard. But I think that's the variable with alcohol. If you throw alcohol into the mix, people lose any ability to inhibit bad behavior. And I've got another one that I want to toss out for you. Yeah. And I'm reading it right out of the Diagnostic and Statistical mm-hmm. Manual. And this is related to narcissism. It's in the same Cluster B category. Mm-hmm. Borderline personality disorder. Mm-hmm. And the hallmark of borderline personality disorder is intense, unstable intimate relationships. They have a fear of abandonment and may cling tightly to partners or push them away out of fear they'll be left. Mm-hmm. They have rapid shifts in mood. They can go from idealizing someone, you're perfect, to devaluing them, you're terrible. And this can happen really quickly, like instantaneously. They can be triggered. Emotional intensity. They feel emotions very deeply and have sudden mood shifts. Impulsivity. They may act out with reckless spending, sex, or substance abuse during emotional distress. Trust issues. They may misinterpret actions or words and assume the worst. Mm-hmm. And when I read those text messages from her to him, boy, to me, this just screamed borderline personality disorder.
It does. And I've had a lot of personal experience with that in my life. I won't go into that, but I totally get that. But the reality is, though, too, borderline can encompass a lot of narcissistic traits. I mean, yes. The two are very, very similar. That's why half the books out there on it basically kind of cover both in almost the same way. What mm-hmm. is the difference between a borderline and a narcissist and someone with narcissistic personality disorder? Not just the traits. We all have traits, but someone who's sure. really, you know, in the diagnosable area.
Yeah, the key difference. I mean, you know, there are a lot of subtle differences, mm-hmm. but you sort of look at what is the predominant theme. And with borderline, it's this relationship stuff, which may only show up in their romantic relationships, mm-hmm. and the rest of life works pretty well for them. But with narcissism, it's more global, that you see this aggrandizing, this I am better than everyone else. And so they will typically have more problems vocationally when they're not recognized the way they think they want to be recognized. And we just haven't really heard evidence that that's her style in mm-hmm. the world. It may be, you know, but I don't know. And as you say, it's possible that you have the features of both of those.
Mm-hmm. Because when we look at what we know about Karen Reed, there obviously is a lot of issues of being a fear of being abandoned seems to be the yeah. kind of ongoing theme with a lot of this. A lot of paranoia, the Aruba trip where she freaks out because there's that friend of the family that he's talking to at the bar, gave a hug to, and then she flips out on.
Yeah.
Later says she apologized and moved on. Who knows if that's true, but that's what she said. Because later on, she even uses that while she tries to seduce one of the officers in this. Mm-hmm. And I always forget his name. It's one of those things where it just keeps happening over and over, where there's this ongoing fear no matter what one says, no matter what one does, no matter how John demonstrates his dedication to her, not cheating on her, mm-hmm. introducing her to the kids, allowing them to get close. Individuals like this don't, that's how they are. They don't necessarily yeah. seem to change a whole lot if that's kind of their way of thinking. Is that accurate?
You can work with, if it's more in the borderline category, this fear of abandonment, mm-hmm. that is the one Cluster B disorder that you can get some progress in therapy if mm-hmm. you specifically address that fear of abandonment. And you know, at the core of that is generally self-loathing. Mm-hmm. They don't feel lovable. They have a lot of self-hatred. Yeah. And if they're motivated to work on that, you can see progress with people. Mm-hmm. But again, it depends on how motivated they are.
Sure. It would make a lot of sense there. The other thing that I hear in a lot of arguments here on, especially, you know, Karen herself, she's so high functioning. She was a professional woman. She had a lot going on. She did. I mean, without yeah. a doubt, very successful in her career. There's nothing wrong with this. Never married, never had kids. but I mean, it's part of her profile of who she is. That is interesting because I think sometimes people go and say, think, well, if she was capable of doing this, she couldn't have been good over in this area. That's not usually the case. You can be super high functioning, super successful, and you can have this and you can kind of go one extreme way very, very fast.
Yeah. And the key, particularly with borderline, is it may only show up in intimate relationships. Mm-hmm. And the rest of life, if you have a bright person, it doesn't show up because there isn't that transference of, I need you. Mm-hmm. This love, whatever, if we want to call it love, you can call it a lot of things. But it's when you get into that romantic area that you see this kind of personality problem manifest. And they may do really well in other parts of their lives.
Let's talk about her reactions after the fact to all of this, whether she believes she hit him or not. Just take that out of the fact that John is dead. This guy that she was in a 2-year relationship with was, pretty close, it seems. But at the end there, she's trying to flirt with somebody else. John's dead. And the emotional reaction is it grief? Is it guilt? Is it something else? Because no matter how many years pass, the person you love, if they're tragically killed in some way, shape, or form, whether you're involved in it or not, I would think that grief would be there. I don't know how one just brushes that away and talks about it like, poor guy. Yeah, it's the last time he gets into that car. We've seen the clips. It's very, very cold, very bizarre. Mm-hmm. Does that play into this as well, that sort of behavior after the fact?
It's hard to say, and was she different privately? Mm-hmm. How did she grieve? People do it differently. The thing that strikes me is that there always did seem to be a self-serving element in it, mm-hmm. in the story, which I guess is understandable. She doesn't want to be held accountable for it, mm-hmm. and doesn't want to admit to herself if she was indeed accountable for it. But it's another piece that makes it unusual, mm-hmm. because the grief certainly doesn't seem like the way you or I would do it. It mm-hmm. looks off.
It feels not like, oh my gosh, I am feeling the pain of losing this person. This is my take on it. It feels more like, how is this going to affect me?
Right.
How are people going to look at me?
Yeah.
Where does that start in life for someone where that seems to be the motivation? Is the ego? It's the I have to be adored. I have to be viewed a certain way. It doesn't have to be adored. I have to be viewed this certain way, and nothing mm-hmm. can shatter that. I don't want anything to shatter it. And they will go to very, very large extremes to prevent people from viewing them as something that they don't want to be viewed as, whether or not they committed these acts or not. I'm sure Karen doesn't want to be viewed as someone who is cheating on the guy she might have just killed. I'm sure Karen doesn't want to be viewed as the woman who killed the guy she was dating. Do they know no end sometimes to the way that they will, I don't want to say cover something up, but I mean, that's kind of what it is. It seems like a reshifting of reality for them mm-hmm. sometimes. How deep does that shift go? Is it a conscious shift for individuals who take such a strong stance against something that, despite the records, despite all the evidence, they just will not accept what the reality is? Almost as if you had a video camera of a child stealing a cookie. And they will lie to you even when you play the tape back going, that wasn't me. Mm-hmm. That sort mm-hmm. of take no prisoners. I don't care who this affects. I am going to repeat my narrative over and over and over. That is where logic goes out the window. What is going on with individuals who are doing that?
And that piece does feel more narcissistic, mm-hmm. doesn't it? Because it's the concern about how I am going to be viewed, the attempt to control the narrative, rather than, I think for most of us, we would go into such a deep sense of mourning and guilt that we would be more open to saying, I really screwed up here. I mm-hmm. did something, whether I still don't think it was intentional, but, I think most people would have so much self-recrimination that there would be a very different flavor in how they present.
Yeah, not taking the accountability. And what adds this to another layer of it, and I'll just say, you know, what it is, you know, on the surface, you tell me what the hell you think is going on here. The fact that she could sit back and watch all of these people have their names drug through the mud, be attacked emotionally, physically by her band of flying monkeys and the pink-wearing people behind the blogger. Just watch this madness occur and watch these people be torn apart. People that she was supposedly, you know, kind of getting friendly with, that were good friends of John. And she sees all of this happening. And let's assume she knows she hit him. Let's assume that she knew that and she's still, you know, going down this road of, no, I didn't. These people did it. What the hell does that say about someone if you're able to watch other people suffer? Even like teenagers. I mean, the Colin Elbert, he had his whole college plans, you know, thrown up in the air at him because of all the accusations that were going against him. Ruined lives. I mean, or at least lives are going to have to really dramatically reshift to get back on track. And you're sitting there going, wasn't me.
What's going on there? It almost feels malevolent. I remember one of the TV interviews she did where she said with great emotional intensity that Jen McCabe is going down.
Yeah, it's you or me.
You or me. And you know, Jen McCabe was the one who came out to try to help her and was driving, you know, or going around with her looking for John and trying her best to be supportive and Googling how long to die in the snow. I mean, you know, the woman was there for her. Mm-hmm. And to turn on her like this, along with everything they've done to everybody else who were supposedly their friends, that really has a stinky smell.
Yeah, I would say without a doubt. I want to go back to the other point for a second of how they present to others, because so many will go, she's a lovely woman. She's very charismatic. She's very fun. She's, you know, again, successful, all of that. And that may appear on the surface, but can people identify individuals like that if they're not in the romantic relationship with them? If that seems to be the trigger, is how they're presenting in the romantic relation specifically? Or is this just something where so many people who've been in relationships with borderlines, you walk out of them and people look at that other partner and go, well, she was lovely. Why would you ever have a problem with this? I mean, they're very good at putting on a mask.
Yeah, that's very, very common where people with one of these personality types will present wonderfully, and they have a manipulative quality. I was married to one too, which is in the book Nightbird, where you know, you have somebody with a very strong malevolent streak or a very strong insecure paranoid streak, and yet other people find them charming. And so it's hard if you're not in an intimate relationship with them to see it. And most people don't.
The supportive group that was outside of the courtroom in trial number one, where Karen talked in the documentary, it's like an ego bath before I go in. It feels lovely. There's like five people out there these days. It's really died down, it seems. And the blogger who is behind a lot of it is resorting to using bots and artificial intelligence to make it appear as if there's more people still supporting Karen Reed. Let's talk about that, just that collective delusion or empowerment. I mean, what is going on there where such a large group of people get together behind this cause? And reality be damned. Maybe you get into it thinking you're doing the right thing, thinking, yeah, this was kind of shady over here on the part of the police. There's a lot of weird pieces to this case, without a doubt. And maybe you think you're in the right. But as this has slowly trickled away, it seems a lot of those followers have trickled away too. Some seem to have some common sense here, but others are still sitting there with the signs. What's happening in those brains?
It's so fascinating. I think a lot of it has to do with the internet now. And there was a recent study where I believe it was in Reddit, And people, they did some research on people with strong opinions and then sent in bots to argue with them and show other points of view. And I don't remember exactly what the topics were, but they shifted opinions with the power of internet posts. And I think people like their team sports. They like the camaraderie of choosing sides and choosing a story that makes them feel like, oh, wow, I've got the inside truth here.
Yeah.
And so it gets kind of conspiratorial. And the internet really fuels it. And it has, you know, people go into their echo chambers. It has tremendous power to shape people, which I think we like to believe. Humans like to believe that we're all logical and we make our decisions based on facts. We really don't. Mm-hmm. Most of us, most of the time, are choosing what facts we believe based upon the emotions that we have. And so I think a lot of the blogging that went on and the content on the internet was very driven by emotional appeals, and that this poor woman is being victimized and these awful cops are in this conspiracy. Not just awful cops, murderous cops mm-hmm. are in this conspiracy. And people get very caught up in it. It's kind of scary to see.
The getting caught up in a part is fascinating to me because they don't have any skin in the game. It's not like they're a family member. They didn't know John. They didn't know Karen. They're not reporting on it like many of us are. They're just there. They're mm-hmm. lending their bodies and their voice to the cause itself. Why? I mean, sometimes when people go down and bad things come out about them, people just kind of walk away and stop talking about them all that much. I just watched a documentary on Netflix yesterday about Brett Favre, where he was in a lot of deep crap for some of the stuff that he was doing, from cheating on his wife to the scandal involving welfare funds and building a tennis arena basically for his daughter, and all the allegations there. But folks that were big into, you know, the legend of Brett Favre, either they completely block that part out and they just stick with the, well, I remember the good times. Or it's just, yeah, we don't talk about him anymore. What about these folks that dig in deep going, well, that's horrible that she said that or did that, but hell, I'm digging in deeper, because that mm-hmm. seems to be what some do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%. And I think it's just this tendency to think emotionally. And once they've chosen a side, they would rather stick with it and dig in rather than look at the ugly reality that they have been misled, or mm-hmm. they have been on the wrong side. And that's very, very hard for some people to do. My gosh, we see it with politics all the time, where somebody has taken a stand and one person is God and the other is Satan. And it doesn't matter what evidence may come out to dispute that, they simply are not going to see it and they're not going to budge. It's again, not a admirable human quality, but you do see it in a lot of areas.
And it's interesting how they can look at the details and still think, hey, this is a great idea. One the other day, actually this morning, I was looking at some tweets out there, and I saw one person bragging about how the Free Karen Reed Fund, which, again, I don't know where it's going to because she's not paying the attorneys. I'm guessing expert witnesses, you know, there's certainly, you know, travel costs. I get there are some expenses here, maybe not $1 million worth if you're not paying those attorneys, but their bill, I'd imagine, would be that, if not far, far more. But they were bragging about how proud they were that they had raised that, and that she could use that money for buying her clothing. And we've seen her really be using that. I've seen a lot of people break down her dresses and her pantsuits and everything. And some of these outfits, my God, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000. Some of them a bit less, but that's a lot of money for an outfit for your murder trial. And you're sitting here begging people to give you money for your defense fund. And clearly, well, the money's going somewhere, and it seems a lot of that's going over there. But there was this level of pride in that from again, just people who are like, oh, I just gave my hard-earned money to that so she could buy a, you know, $1,500 suit. That just seems to be so insane. It's like, yes, the emperor has no clothes, but let's buy him more. It's a very strange dynamic.
It's very strange. And I actually had not researched how much she was spending on outfits. I didn't spend that much on a wedding dress. I mean, you know, that's crazy. And again, the fact that she feels comfortable doing that is again, doesn't speak of integrity. It's very, very strange. And the fact that people are proud of contributing to it. Wow. Crazy.
Yeah, people are, some of them have been lining up to contribute to that, which it's just, yeah, it's very, very bizarre. It is almost like a brainwashing thing of, yes, you say I will do, and this is great. I don't know. There's a lot of red flags, obviously, on the digital trail in this case, too. Reed had texts and calls that really revealed her state of mind in some very critical moments. Karen texted, "John's dead," before his body was officially discovered. She sent multiple messages to witnesses urging them, you know, there's just so many things about this case where her own words, her own texts, they're out there. And she seems to pretend that she didn't say certain things. Her own dad talks about, yeah, Karen and I talked to her in the hospital, and she told me that she struck something. And it says it's all there. I mean, take the vehicle data out of it that now scientifically shows the strike. But it's like one can say something in one word world over here or in one conversation or in one room, and then the next you can say the exact opposite. Same people are in that room, and she seems to expect people to just go along with the narrative. Is she aware that she's doing that? I mean, again, all speculation, but are people like this aware that they're doing that?
Partially aware, I would think. There's a very interesting ability to shift perspective and to shift perception. And I think often when people are telling stories, they believe it at the time. But then they go into the shift of perspective and they can alter the stories. And at that point, they're believing that new story. Now, if you tried to call them out on it and say, but here's video of you saying something completely different, if they were going to sit with that, it's not like they're delusional. Obviously, they'd have to say, yeah, I did say that. But I think we're not seeing a lot of that with her at this point. She's desperate to you know, beat this case.
Yeah. And just more and more every day. Here's an interesting one. It was brought out in her own words, again, just the other day. And if we play along with the timeline here, in her own words, this is after the fact. This is not like a police report. This is not a, she's saying it in the moment. This is in an interview that we, that was an interesting we there. I don't know who the we necessarily refers to. Maybe her dad in that moment when they were together. We thought he, you know, he probably died around 12:25 or 12:30. Well, that would put her there. That would basically make the whole story of the he got beat up and drug out in the snow completely impossible. Why would you say that? Is it, did they... Folks like this, they're not infallible. That's the thing. No. They think they're infallible, but they're not.
Right.
Do people like this tend to slip up a lot, but really they don't notice it, and unless they get called on the carpet on it, it just kind of goes?
Yeah, yeah. And that's that shifting perspective, shifting narrative, and that lack of awareness that, you know what, the story changed here. And then there's that self-serving aspect of, okay, I'm not ever going to admit it. I'm not ever going to own it.
Yeah. I mean, the narrative shifts as time progresses and as she's suggested stories by her attorneys that this is what happened. I found that very interesting too, where, I mean, she professes, I was thinking this, what else could it be, for a long time, referring to her hitting John. And then suddenly the attorney meets with the weird, shady man that says, look at the people in the house. And that's all that's said, apparently. And then they suddenly tell Karen, you couldn't have possibly hit him because look at the people in the house. She adopts that narrative suddenly because it was a suggestion. Is that, I mean, obviously you're wanting something to say it's not you. But clearly, if you know it is you, and just somebody says, well, maybe this could be a possibility, how does one just jump ship to that when they know damn well that Yeah, I mean, a plausible theory if no one actually knew what happened. But if you know what happened, you know damn well that's not true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's, you know, when there's that kind of shift, it makes one wonder about the lack of an inner moral compass, you know, because if you know you're lying and you're ruining other people's lives, people that have cared about you and been friends, again, it speaks of a lack of integrity, and it's a disturbing sign.
Let's talk about Dad a little bit, because he's been out there supporting Karen, as, you know, a lot of parents certainly would. But he's been the one that has said a lot of things, too, that very much incriminate Karen Reed. But he still is there every day needing to make those statements to reporters. He can just shut up and not need to say anything. He can just go his way. He doesn't have to come out and make some vitriolic statement. I mean, he's entitled to, but it's not required. What does that say about any of this? Because it seems the apple doesn't far very fall from the tree. A need to be heard, a need to control the narrative, even when they're very sloppy about controlling the narrative. The third party theory, that has yet to really, you know, get its legs in this case yet, but we're anticipating that it's going to take off. Do you think it's going to be just as dramatic as the first time, with the story being told exactly as it was the first time, of a possible fight, of the dog, of this or that? Or are they going to have to lean back, because it does look rather ridiculous when you take a step back and see just how many people theoretically would need to be involved for this theory to be real?
Tony, you're being way too logical and analytical. I mean, if you look at this third-party culprit defense,
you're cutting out.
Party for one of their sons all of a sudden decided to murder him for no particular reason and beat him to death of all things.
Yeah.
And throw him on the front lawn. And like you said, all the people that have to be involved, all the agencies, 70 different people I've counted that, you know, were CW witnesses, potentially they were on the list, may not have been called because they're duplicates, but all these people involved.
Yeah.
It's so ridiculous, but all they need is one juror that is a conspiracy theorist or a stealth juror to buy it. And, you know, we could have another hung jury on our hands.
And that's the scary thing about all of this, because there seems to be a lot of very smart minds out there that can just look at this on the surface. I don't think it takes a smart mind, really, to just look at this on the surface and go, okay, here's what likely happened. I don't see another way around this, but you certainly do have a lot of people that are going down the route of this is a conspiracy, and that they're fully drinking up the house theory, which, again, you don't have to do to believe that she may be factually innocent. I think the evidence points far more to guilt these days than innocent, but you don't have to believe the house story. But people are still very much in that. How do you think things are at right now with the jury? Obviously, there's a lot more to come, but how do you think they're taking all of this in, and how do you think they're taking the cross-examinations that we're seeing from the defense in terms of, you know, seriousness, in terms of having valid points that they're trying to argue? Is any of it landing with the jury at this point?
You know, I wish I could see their faces, and I still may be going up there because that gives so much information. It seems that they were most engaged with the testimony of Jim McCabe and the testimony of John O'Keefe's niece. And I find that interesting. You know, leaning forward on their seats was reported, and that they were taking copious notes. When I hear things like that, that tells me that they think that that testimony is very important to them. When it comes to these experts, and I know you've sat and listened to this, I mean, it's hours. It's not hours. It's actually days that you have to listen to this. And quite frankly, it really is tedious and boring. Part of the cross-examination done on the DNA expert by Alan Jackson, he asked the same question. I was keeping track approximately six times because he wasn't getting the answer he wanted. And mm-hmm. finally, Judge Cannone said, please, let's move along. So guess what Alan Jackson did? Mm-hmm. He asked the exact same question again, even though he had been told to move along. So that's hard for a jury that's sitting there to really engage with mm-hmm. all that duplicitous question, answer, and technical issues. I thought the DNA experts were amazing in terms of how they came off. So if you think that Jen McCabe, if they believe Jen McCabe, if they believe the niece who said the, you know, the relationship was on the rocks, mm-hmm. and then now if they're really parsing through all of this DNA information and the timestamp information, it's a logical conclusion that she hit him.
Yeah. What was your reaction? Obviously, we didn't get a chance to see the niece's testimony, but we certainly heard all about it from the reporting in the courtroom. And it sounded like it was pretty powerful. And it also conflicted with what Karen had been saying about them, her being so close with the kids. And for whatever reason, John just didn't like that, or he was uncomfortable with it. That's paraphrasing what Karen summed up. Sounds like it's the exact opposite. Sounds like they knew something was up with Karen. Karen seemed a bit unstable. They didn't know who they were getting every single day. A lot of people going to argue, well, they're kids. They were influenced all this time by these people. Kids are pretty honest, I think, when it comes to something like this. How do you think that landed? And do you think the jury is going to take that as one of the more powerful pieces at the end of the day in this trial?
I think it's very powerful. It's powerful because they want to understand if Karen Reed is the type of person that could do this, and not that she had a motive to hit him per mm-hmm. se, but what was her mindset? What kind of person was she? Was she a person that was capable of hurting somebody in this way and leaving them? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what this shows, is her mindset. You know, they chose only to go with the niece because, remember, she woke up the niece out of a dead sleep, mm-hmm. didn't have the number for John's friends, and said, you know, oh my gosh, you know, was frantic mm-hmm. in front of this niece. And I think that shows also the mindset of her that morning. And she got in some very important facts, such as Karen Reed saying she thought he might have been hit by a plow, and could she have hit him? Mm-hmm. So, you know, what person would not believe this niece? I think everybody is going to believe the niece. And she laid some, I think, important groundwork, plus just the heartstrings of it all.
How much of, I mean, another part of this case that we didn't get a chance, that we didn't have last time, is Karen's words, Karen's mouth, Karen talking in all these interviews. And there's just so much that we continue to see that comes out from the cutting room floor. How much do you think that is going to be weighing on the juror's mind this time around as well? Because her story, obviously, credibility is a big thing here. When they talk about the LinkedIn page and the guy's resume, Karen doesn't really stand very strong in terms of credibility here.
No, she doesn't. And unless you are just firmly in her camp, and those people that are, they're not watching the trial. I don't believe they're listening to, you know, the blogger mm-hmm. who, you know, is squarely in her camp, and others on YouTube and such for their information, as opposed to really dialing down in on the trial. And, you know, stations like yours that actually go to the facts, you seek people who are watching the trial, who are know the facts. Mm-hmm. There's that camp, and then there's the camp that really just goes to the drama side of this case.
Yeah. How do you think this, I mean, Avi, I'm not asking for how do you think the jury's going to find, but how do you think this ends in terms of all of the drama in this case? Let's say she's found guilty. Does this end to the few? I mean, I want to say few, but judging from who's showing up outside the building, you can't put bots outside a building, but you can certainly buy them online and make it appear as though you have more followers and more people actively engaging in this conversation than are actually there, which we know is going on from the defense side of Karen Reed or whoever is behind the social end of things. How do you think this goes at the end of the day? Do they end up moving on to something else? And, you know, Karen's just kind of left here. Are they all expecting them to keep fighting the good fight for Karen? Or is everybody just going to be like, I've had enough and Karen can fight her fight on her own?
Well, if you look, and I know you just made reference to it, I think I counted 12 the other day that are screaming for her, right? And so her numbers are so far down in terms of people willing to take time out of their day now and fight the good fight. I think that in part, some will stay with it, but I'm hoping, I got to tell you what I'm hoping. I hope that they put their efforts toward the Sandra Birchmore case, where there was clear political corruption, where there was a guy, I mean, it's a sickening case where, again, another medical examiner made a huge mistake ruling that a suicide instead of a homicide from the same office, by the way, as this medical examiner, which was a bit of a soup sandwich, not committed to anything.
Yeah.
Right. Well, the aliens could have killed John O'Keefe, according to her, pretty much. Right. It was anything and everything was a possibility. So I hope that they refocus and really look at that corruption that was at Stoughton and that group of a band of thieves, because, you know, just horrible what happened in that community.
I know there was arguments early on. They were trying to bring some of the Sandra Birchmore information into this case. The judge said not going to have it. The way that things have been slipping in here, as we talked about earlier with the, you know, the dog bites and things like that that are written on some of the images. Do you think that they're going to still try and slip this in here where it's going to end up being brought up in this case and then arguments are going to be able to be made about any of that in terms of the credibility of the police and their relation to that case over here, which, you know, could be troublesome?
You know, I don't think so. I think she will stay steadfast about that. There's really only two officers, well, three, that had such minor involvement in the case, except for Guarino, who also was involved in the extraction. But everybody needs to understand, those officers that extract information from cell phones, they don't analyze it. They literally have one job, and that is to make sure they get all pictures, data, emails, et cetera, off of a particular device. That's it. They're not supposed to analyze it or anything else. They hand that off to the investigators. And so really, it wasn't on his plate to really do a full analysis. So it's just interesting. He's really the only one to me that had any sort of, you know, involvement other than was the first on scene and left.
Sure. Yeah. That'll be a fascinating case. And I agree. Take the energy and use it for good. Use it for a case where there actually is some really bad things happening here that do involve officers. Go look at Delphi. There's another one that maybe folks should take a little energy and go after for someone who's been wrongly convicted. Just fascinating to watch. It's almost a really interesting social experiment, seeing just how caught up people can be. Have you ever seen a case like this where it's gotten to be so two completely dramatic opposite sides? And it almost feels like everybody's watching a completely different case and interpreting things in completely opposite directions.
You know, I'm glad you said that, Tony, because that's what the interpretation is. You know, you could say the same sentence and the two different sides would interpret it completely opposite for whatever helped their objective. And that's really sad. That's why I always, even this morning on Yellow Cottage Tales, who was Kevin Linehan, who's been covering it very closely, wrote a book that he just released on it. It was so interesting because even they were diverging from the facts. And at the end of the day, Tony, everyone needs to revert back to facts, not drama, not all this sideshow. And I think it would be very easy for both sides to agree. And I'm actually seeing some, not wholehearted FKR people, but some people come around and now they're saying, you're right, she's guilty, but the investigation was just too bad for me to convict. At least that's the step in the right direction that they're seeing the facts are there.
Yeah, and that seems to be where I think a lot of people are. The investigation was just too bad to convict, which then ends up making her factually innocent, even if she is not, in fact, really innocent. But again, facts are facts. You can keep adding more and more things to the soup. It's not going to make it any better, and it doesn't change the core of what it is at the end of the day, what the base of this thing is. But there's still a lot to go, and I'm really wondering if reasonable doubt is going to win the case here for Karen Reed, or if we're going to be sitting here again with another hung jury. And if we have another hung jury, what happens then? Are we going to do this for a third time, or do we just say, okay, we're done?
Well, first of all, Tony, if it's a hung jury, it 100% we will be. If it's a hung jury, I think they will try her again for the third time. And don't forget, Tony, what's hanging out there? What's hanging out there are all of these civil cases against her.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of them, most notably the O'Keefe's, the wrongful death. And we saw this with O.J. Simpson, found guilty or found innocent criminally, but not
civilly.
But found responsible and culpable in a civil trial where it's this the preponderance of the evidence that he committed the crime. Is that interrupting, Tony?
You're there. No, you're good. You were cutting in and out a little bit, but I could hear you.
Okay.
So we're good. Now there's just so damn much. I'm wondering every day, is this the future of cases? Are we going to see a lot more vitriol like this in other cases on each side? Is this just a reflection of how society is right now? And this is get used to it basically, or is there something special about the Karen Reed case that created this type of atmosphere?
I think the Karen Reed case is a sign of what's to come. I'm already seeing it on Idaho. Delphi, it never really exploded like I think it would have if anybody had any idea what was going on at that trial.
Yeah.
You know, they kept everything so under wraps, but we're already seeing it on Idaho. I think we are in a whole new situation and wave in terms of social media and sleuthing influences on these trials and what people think about them.
I would agree. I don't know if that's good or bad, that you have more people out there looking at things and maybe you can find things better with more resources, or if this is just going to end up creating more and more confusion for anything, you know, that gains any sort of traction out there in the public. A lot of questions.
Yeah, I'm just hoping that I really am hoping the jury sticks with what they see in the courtroom. I fear that that's almost impossible. But I'm trying to hope that they do, because if they stick with what they see in this jury trial, she will be convicted.
It's been a lot of new testimony coming out, new evidence coming out, expert witnesses saying some, depending how you take it, pretty damning things or things that raise more questions. Again, it's the two sides of this case that take every piece and go, this is great for me. This is, I mean, okay, I guess you can kind of, maybe, sort of, I don't know, depending on how you want to spin it. Joining me to discuss all the latest in the trial of Karen Reed, Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor. There's been a lot. Just had Dr. Azik Wolf testifying the other day. He's the neurosurgeon. Who just reminded me so much of on Seinfeld, Investigator Bookman from the library. We're just very much, yes. What do you think about that, Jerry? But very, like, knows his stuff. I wouldn't question Dr. Bookman, and I wouldn't question Dr. Azik Wolf, who testified. Eric, from a legal strategy perspective here, How does a defense team leverage this expert testimony when the prosecution thinks it's pretty strong? I mean, he basically said the injury to John O'Keefe's head that came from falling on the back of his head, not from a strike in the front, not from a hammer, not from a fist, not from anything, but falling back on his head. What are your thoughts?
You know, that's going to be a tough one for defense to navigate because, as you know, their general theory is that John O'Keefe went into the house. There was some physical altercation. He was killed and then or injured and then brought outside in the front of the house. You know, could the defense argue that, hey, there's that gash on John O'Keefe's eye. Maybe he was hit in the front and that caused him to hit his head. And then he became unconscious and they carried him out into the front yard, these cops who did this to another cop. But you can see that sort of gets attenuated and a little bit incredulous as we sort of go down that road.
A little ridiculous as it keeps going on. Yeah, I mean, I've seen the reactions from some of the FKR folks. And they immediately go to, well, the basement has a hard concrete floor. Okay, sure. But there's no evidence pointing to him ever getting in the house, including Karen, in her own words, saying, you know, well, later she says she saw him get into the house. But initially, for the first however many weeks of this thing, there was none of that. And she found him where she thought she left him. So there's that. They can easily scream, conspiracy! That's how it is. They're covering it all up. And I guess so that's one could try to explain that. But that doesn't work in a courtroom very well. Just screaming, conspiracy! Everything is shady. I mean, or does it work in a courtroom?
It depends on the case, depends on the jury. But one thing as a prosecutor, when those sorts of claims would be made by defense, sometimes I would just sort of draw out all of the events that would have to occur in terms of proving that conspiracy and how implausible they were. And just say, hey, either Karen Reed is the unluckiest person in the world who is being framed and there was this massive conspiracy with all of these events that had to transpire. She did. And you know, jury, what appears to be most plausible? What appears to be the simple common sense interpretation of this evidence? And I think we're going in the direction of a conviction.
Yeah, it certainly feels that way. I mean, if you believe the experts or if you just kind of cherry pick which ones you want to say are valid, which seems to be, you know, it happens in every case. You have the battle of the experts on both sides. Well, this one seems to say this, and I completely don't believe that one. Really, for not a lot of great reasons half the time. What did you think this week when the arguments came up about, who was it, Shannon Burgess, the individual who had the timestamp data? He figured out a way to get deeper, and he very well explained it. It was boring as hell, but he very well explained how he got into the data of the Lexus and the SD card he had to find and all this stuff to pull the data to get to where he got to line the timestamps up, which just happened to look like they line up with a vehicle strike, where the vehicle says it struck something and John O'Keefe's phone stopped moving. Pretty damning. Let's talk about the actual evidence first versus the rebuttal. What do you think about those pieces?
You know, on direct examination, I really think the prosecution kind of stepped their game up in this second trial here. This is a creative, next level sort of meta-analysis between multiple electronic systems to sync up the fact that, according to the prosecution, John O'Keefe's phone, which prosecution says was outside the house, stopped having interactions with it at pretty much the exact same time that Karen Reed's vehicle was in reverse and then, you know, left the scene. You know, that pretty clearly shows that there was a vehicle strike, according to the prosecution. And I thought it was clever and compelling, at least on direct.
Clever and compelling, yes. It's, I guess, the question, and I'm sure they're going to try and raise this with the defense of, you know, well, why did this get in? They've already tried to argue, why did this get in so late? But are they going to try and go with the credibility of it? They're trying to go with the credibility of the guy, of Shannon Burgess, who delivered it, by going after his resume, where he had talked about getting a bachelor's degree. He didn't quite get the bachelor's degree. This was on his LinkedIn, and I think it was on the website, on his bio. I mean, it's not a great look. That's a T that should have been crossed and an I that should have been dotted. But we're talking about his expertise in this being certifications that really have nothing to do with his bachelor degree. They said all of his certifications that he laid out very much are in line with what you would need to come to the conclusion or to be a credible witness, expert witness, for what he is talking about here. It's a lot of noise, but is any of that going to stick with a jury? Do you think that his credibility, how successful do you think the defense was at trying to cut up his credibility, considering they didn't talk anything about the actual evidence?
You know, sometimes when you're in that gauntlet and the analysis seems pretty sound, but there's, you know, this little gift that the prosecution gives you regarding Burgess's background and his misrepresentations, you got to pounce on that. And you got to try to, you know, capitalize on that and convey to this jury, gosh, this guy lied about having this bachelor's degree. Talking about an expert who has to be qualified. That's at least part of his qualifications that he's just lying to you about, jury. And so, you know, that is, I think defense made the most of it that they could, but there wasn't a very solid challenge to the science of the opinion in my prison.
Let's say, and this is just a theoretical here, had they not found that hiccup on his resume, what would they have gone after? I mean, what would they have? They definitely were struggling to find something. And then that one just kind of came to them. Here's what you should say. Here's what you should do. It was a, you know, just a golden ticket right there. But if that wasn't there, how did they counter something like that?
You know, my understanding is that there was some possible variance in sort of the numbers and the timestamps or whatever. But I think the prosecution did a pretty good job of kind of explaining the thrust of the testimony and why it matters. Absent that, you know, blunder regarding Burgess's background, this would have been a pretty unassailable witness, I think.
Just the idea that there's a vehicle strike registering on her car in the relative same area where John O'Keefe's phone stopped working. I mean, we're talking minutes here. I mean, they got this down to like seconds now, but even within minutes, I think it would seem pretty reasonable to a juror to go, well, yeah, clocks can be off, but this thing registered a strike right around the same time his phone stopped working. I mean, unless he ran into the house and got beat up there in the course of 2 minutes and 30 seconds and was dragged back out and Karen still happened to be there. I mean, none of it makes sense. None of it would actually work for the house timeline and the whole fight theory, would it?
Not in my opinion. And really, the prosecution is doing a good job of shoring up any possible openings that the defense could try to exploit in terms of reasonable doubt. But by this, you know, precise and you know, high level technological analysis that is hard to argue with. It's based on data. You know, we're talking about when a phone says it was last used and what a car says in terms of backing in or in terms of reversing. And those things seem to line up precisely with the prosecution's theory that this was a vehicle strike. And it's really starting to dry up any grounds that the defense could try to assert in terms of closing argument. That's partly why the defense was so obstinate that they did not want this evidence in at this late time in the trial, because they knew it would be centrally damaging to their theory.
It is. It is certainly centrally damaging, again, depending on how the jury takes it. Another big thing recently in the trial of Karen Reed, Hank Brennan's got the clips. He keeps going through them. And I think there's like, as we're sitting, there's like 21 or some more clips still to come. I can't wait. Because thank goodness the folks at Investigation Discovery who did the doc didn't delete their stuff from the cutting room floor. Not that you normally would, but they had the goods. I'm wondering how long they sat there thinking, gee, we might need to provide this at some point. They did a good job just on the doc, but I mean, this is like, you know, the DVD extras almost that they could have been had people still get DVDs. What else do you think, pure speculation, we're going to hear from Karen Reed before we actually talk about some of the things we did hear from Karen Reed out of her own words this week?
Gosh, you know, so far there have been clips that really show some inconsistencies. There have been statements in those clips from Karen Reed that really directly undermine the defense's theory that John O'Keefe went inside. And so, you know, what more could be coming out? I'm sure Hank Brennan has some, you know, good cards up his sleeve that he has not yet played. He has been rather masterful in his presentation, in my opinion. And I think that he's got some bangers that are just waiting to come out. Hard to say exactly what they'll be, but I think they're going to be bad for Karen Reed.
If you're the prosecutor, are you waiting till is this like the fireworks show? Like we're seeing them popping off. Ooh, that's a good one. Oh my gosh, look, it's Mickey Mouse. And then at the end, you have the finale. Are you expecting there to be a finale of clips at the very end of this where it's just going to be a damn, that was a good show?
I completely am. And that is the way to do it. You know, the prosecution has to capture this jury's attention over a long period of time. This is not a short trial. And you have to do, you know, you can't have bombshells every single day, but people develop a tolerance to that. But you've definitely got to save something for kind of a crescendo at the end. And I imagine there could even be a mashup of different statements. You know, they could play, oh, Karen Reed saying, there's no chance I hit him or whatever. And then another clip where she's saying, I could hit him. Yeah, I could have. I wonder if they're going to contrast these discrepancies in her prior statements in some sort of mashup that just tears her apart.
Remix! They'll get a DJ in there and like, I hit him. It'll be great. It'll be the first time it's ever happened in a courtroom. What she did say this week, you know, again, through her own words, I find it very ironic. At the beginning of that documentary, she said, this is going to be my testimony. Damn right it is. It is totally your testimony. And you were not thinking when you spoke. One of the clips, she's stating flat out, we think he died around 12:25 to 12:30. That would put her there. I mean, scientifically, it puts her there. It's not an opinion. She would be there based on all of the data, based on the science of where her phone is, where her car is, where John is, where everything is. It puts her there. Why? I mean, did you take that in any other way when that was stated? We thought he died around between 12:25 and 12:30. What the hell does that mean if you're throwing all these other things out there, too?
Yeah, you know, the judge is going to instruct this jury that they do not have to leave their common sense at the door, and rather that they need to utilize that common sense. They need to draw reasonable inferences from the evidence presented, from statements from Karen Reed and from all the other witnesses. This statement seems to be a direct admission that placing her at the scene of where John O'Keefe died at the time he died. You know, she has just put her foot in her mouth repeatedly throughout the pendency of this case. And those things are going to be her death knell, I think.
Is there any other way to take that? I'm honestly just asking. I mean, we thought, and the we is in there too. That's another question. Who's we? But but is there any other way to take it? Was this a statement like at that time we thought it was? I mean, I'm just a trying to put context here where we don't really have a lot of it. I don't know. I mean, it's because it's said very much in a factual way, 12:25 to 12:30. That, of course, would mean that she was aware that he probably died after being struck by the vehicle around that time, or at least that's where she thought he stopped moving, you know, where she expected to find him and all that stuff, too. That's where we get in the closer territory to murder two, because it's not just manslaughter anymore. If you're talking about you think you know that he was dead or dying and you left, that's not a good look.
Totally. I mean, you know, could the defense somehow rehabilitate this at some point? They certainly should try. You know, could they say that that's what Karen Reed thought at the time. And we're getting, you know, we were getting all of this information and trying to process it, trying to come to grips with this horrible tragedy. And that was her impression at one point in time. But now that we have the benefit of further defense expert analysis, we know that not to be true. You know, I think they're going to have to go down a road like that to just try to remedy some of the problems that Karen Reed has brought to her own case.
What do you think their attorneys are thinking every single day while these clips are played? I mean, they know they're out there. They know what's coming up. They have it all in discovery. But what the hell do you think's going through their mind as they try and defend her as best that they possibly can? But then at the end of the day, at the end of everything, it's boom. It's like everything you just accomplished, Karen just destroyed in a statement. What the hell are they thinking?
You know, it's kind of a thought process of almost like, who's my real adversary here? Is it the prosecution or is it my own client who keeps shooting the defense in the foot at which I'm at the helm? You know, it can be, and this is nothing new. You know, in so many cases, the defendant might do something while trial is pending or even during trial where you're just like, what in God's name are you doing? And then you have to kind of scramble and use your expertise to do your best to defend that person. Still, you have to try to bring consistency and coherence to evidence that might appear really inconsistent and incoherent.
Who's we in that statement?
You know, is that it's, you know, Karen Reed wasn't married or her partner, John O'Keefe, died. She didn't have any children. You know, is it her and her girlfriends thought that? Maybe, but is it more likely that it's her and her defense team is the global mm-hmm. we?
Or her dad?
I mean, most likely.
Her dad was there. We have the video where it shows dad out there looking around on the ground, trying to see if he finds more tail light. I mean, I'm wondering if that's the we. I don't know. I mean, it's up for, you know, a debate, I guess, on who that could possibly be, but. Yeah, it's still kind of a mystery in that department of exactly who that could be in the we. There was other statements that were made, including outside of court. She continues to go down the road of, I saw him go in the house. She was asked that directly. Did you see him go in the house? Yes, I did. Can you describe it? No, but I'm sure they'll play it. I just don't know. I mean, what the hell, again, this kind of goes back to the attorneys. Why are they letting her speak? Or do they just have no control over their client at this point? Is this just one thing where they're like throwing their hands in the air going, she's going to do whatever she's going to do. I can't really stop her. Or I don't know. I mean, I would think you'd be trying to like go for your client's best interest. Or do they think it's in her best interest to go out there and just, you know, spew things out of her mouth every day?
You know, I'm wondering if perhaps the defense team was looking at this like, hey, when Karen Reed when this case heated up, got a lot of public attention, Karen Reed got some momentum. And then when she started interacting with her followers and her supporters, that momentum grew. And for a time, it seemed like sort of the media machine that Karen Reed was fueling was helping them. And so perhaps that's the sort of track that the defense got in and said, hey, yeah, keep doing this. It's good. But then it starts to kind of go off course and then it sort of spirals down the hill and perhaps defense is just sort of still in that car and couldn't reverse course at that point. And you know, now, for example, if they prevented her from talking, that would be that would raise a ton of red flags. People would be like, hey, what's going on? How come Karen Reed isn't doing what she's been doing? Mm-hmm. Really the almost the entire pendency of the case.
But wouldn't that be better though? I mean, rather than continuing to cause more damage. I mean, yes, it would look weird. There's been some days where she clearly gets out there and looks rather frazzled. She had some of those moments this week, calling the testimony of Burgess, what was it, extraordinary? Or she initially said something of that nature. She praised it, and then she pulled back going, it was like the opposite. Again, I forgot her exact terminology of what she used, but she didn't have the words that she normally does. She came out there, and you could tell, she was kind of like deer in a headlight a little bit. Not having any comments about her own comments, the clips that were played in court that day, or the timestamp, and also frazzled when asked about that. Do you think she's starting to feel the writing on the wall here? Do you think she herself is feeling like she's being backed into the corner? And do you think the defense team is starting to feel that way too?
You know, yes. And I think leading up to this retrial, some would say Karen Reed was kind of brazen. She was kind of audacious. She was kind of out there. You know, she's talking and she seems to be enjoying the media attention and being her version of charismatic. And then once you get into that gauntlet, things change. And you sometimes the gravity of what is going on in that courtroom and the direction it's going can sort of land in your chest and you feel it. And I can't help but wonder if Karen Reed is like, hey, this isn't going like the first one went.
I wonder, do you think she's had a moment or do you think it's just been kind of a slow build lobster in the pot? I wonder if there's one thing that was just like, I mean, she's had her reactions in court. That's certainly there where it's, you can tell she's not happy about some of the rulings that have come down and what's been played in court. But I'm wondering, I don't know. I mean, was there a moment or just a slow build on this one?
You know, I think there could have been a few moments. Yeah. One was the digital forensics expert who did a locational analysis of John O'Keefe's phone and at least for the most part said that it was very likely to be outside of the home, though there was some cross-examination. And then on top of that, I think Burgess's testimony was problematic for the defense. There was a recent forensic criminalist on the stand who purported to match up some of the plastic debris found on John O'Keefe with the broken taillight from Karen Reed's vehicle. And so I can't help but wonder if these, you know, high points for the prosecution are starting to kind of punch Karen Reed in the gut and she's starting to really come to grips with what's happening.
And they're really going into detail this round and really explaining not just, okay, the expert says that these microscopic pieces of taillight were found in his clothing, as you just mentioned there, Christina Hanley, the forensic trace expert that was testifying the other day, but going into just how detailed that these things were in there, basically stating to a layperson, there's no way you're going to be able to plant these things this way. I mean, it's just, you're not. It's just, it's not going to look like this. You'd have to literally, it would have to come at you in a certain way and a certain volition and a certain energy force to get these things embedded into the clothing at the microscopic level that they were. Not exactly let's take some chunks of taillight and plant it over here, that whole theory. But again, there doesn't seem to be anything that the defense won't try to believe that the cops somehow microscopically planted tiny shards of taillight in his clothing. Okay, if you want to believe that, that's lovely, but I'm going to say it's probably not true. How that was a damning piece, I thought, as well, especially just to a jury that doesn't know the full breadth of this case as the rest of us do, you know, supposedly. But they're hearing that for the first time. They're hearing the timestamp matches up. They're hearing the hatred that Karen seemed to have for him in those voicemails. They're hearing her basically admit to the timestamps matching where she thought he died. And now we have pieces of the damn broken taillight in his clothes. This is not a real complicated whodunit here. This is more like, wake up!
Yeah, I feel you. And you know, I think it's in part a function of the new special prosecutor, Hank Brennan, and the tight ship that he has been at the helm of during this retrial. You know, in the first trial, there were a lot of sense. There were dots that weren't always connected. And so I think Hank Brennan saw that and he said, hey, how do we overcome this conspiracy argument? How do we present a more ironclad coherent story to this jury so they can understand and believe what we're telling them happened. And I think he's done a really good job of that. Like you said, going into detail about the nuance, about sort of the smaller aspects that when, you know, looked at under a microscope, really kind of help show that there's no opening for reasonable doubt in a lot of those analyses.
Obviously, it's the job of her defense to introduce reasonable doubt. That seems to be probably the only way she's going to be getting off here, is trying to find some shard, it's pardon the pun, of reasonable doubt that maybe will resound with something. But you have to walk that fine line when you're a defense attorney of not insulting the intelligence of the jurors, I would think, because nothing kills anybody liking you faster is, you know, insulting their intelligence, or even worse, doing it in a real kind of covert way, passive aggressive way, where we're not going to quite tell you you're an idiot, but we think you might be an idiot. So we're going to frame it this way, even though you're not an idiot. One of those things I thought was interesting, the way that the defense was trying to introduce reasonable doubt into the taillight shards, was the stressing that you can't say conclusively, I believe, that these shards of taillight embedded in his clothes came from this specific taillight. They're the same type of plastic. They're the same color of the taillight. They look like they could be, but there's no way to like forensically put them together like a puzzle because they're just tiny little pieces. And really stressing that, I felt that, I mean, I get what they're doing, but was that the right road to go down to say, well, yes, it could, it's the same make, it's the same this and that, but it could have been another Lexus SUV of the exact same make and model that maybe slammed into John O'Keefe and implanted these pieces into his clothing. That could be a possibility, right? That's where the word reasonable comes into play when it comes to reasonable doubt.
Exactly. I mean, you got to be careful on the defense side with what you're trying to sell to a jury, because they don't want their intelligence insulted. You know, think about if you're like at work and there's some kind of dispute and the first person says, you know, hey, yeah, this guy was making me feel uncomfortable and harassing me. And then the guy says, actually, it was a complete body double. And you can't prove that I don't have a twin or that I haven't been cloned or something. You know, you got to, well, that might be theoretically true.
Yeah.
Is that really what you want to try to sell to a jury? And could that damage your own credibility by making that argument?
Walk me through, because I'm trying to figure out Karen's argument on the piece of glass that was, or some of the pieces of glass that were found on her bumper and the taillight, that they're not pieces of glass that fit into the puzzle physically of the drinking glass. They're tiny shards. So they're pieces, again, that really can't be quite placed as to where they are. Now, granted, it's already been said that John O'Keefe left the car basically with two drinks, from what we understand. Her vodka tonic, and essentially he had one too. That's from all of the minutiae, what I think many of us have come to conclude. Maybe if it's just one, it doesn't, not whatever it may be. What does it matter at this point if there's shards of glass that maybe couldn't be found to be put into the puzzle of the broken glass? Is there another mystery glass we're talking about? Is it the second glass? What? Because Karen seems to be stuck on this too, when out of court the other day making some statements of, well, they didn't know where that glass was from. What? Okay. And? I mean, maybe I'm missing this here. What's the argument?
You know, it's a bit of a head scratch on that one. The argument might be, let me just try to muck up the facts here as best I can.
Yeah.
And hopefully that will lead to some confusion that might translate into reasonable doubt. Because, yeah, you know, if there was a second glass, I don't know, is defense going to argue that the Alberts, you know, beat John O'Keefe with multiple glasses? It really starts to unravel and fall apart when you scrutinize it. And that's the problem for Karen Reed's defense.
Because this mystery glass really doesn't have anything to do with anything. Nobody's saying he got hit in the head with a glass. I mean, there's the the neurosurgeon said, look, this injury is from falling on the back of his head. It's not from a glass being chucked at his head, because there's no contusion like you'd have with a hammer or a flying cocktail glass. So I don't know where the glass is from. I guess one could possibly assume that the glass is from the drinking glass. It's just shards that you can't really place. Again, what does it matter? It has nothing to do. Again, it's look, there's fire over here. Look over here. Glass, shiny. Don't pay attention to this. Is that really what we're dealing with on the glass right now?
It could be that. It could be something like, hey, the prosecution has a duty to explain to you what happened and to explain what the evidence is and where it comes from. And if there are things they can't explain, that's a problem. And that could lead to some kind of doubt, and that could translate into reasonable doubt. I suspect it's going to be some kind of vague argument like that, saying, hey, prosecution has the responsibility of telling you what happened here and what this stuff is, and they can't do it, so don't trust them on other stuff.
Would her better of option had just been to kind of, if in fact she's guilty, if she knew about this, just to have said, look, I was drunk. This was horrible. I feel horrible. Not intentional. And have pled something early on versus this. I mean, if you're to look back in time, what would you have said to her?
You know, I think that this, from defense perspective, could easily be characterized as just a horribly tragic accident. That's something that no one intended. You know, horrible stuff happens. It was a blizzard out, that they were engaged in this sort of chaotic conflict. Emotions were running high, and something really horrible happened. And you know, to try to broker a plea before the first trial, or even possibly better, after the mistrial, because then defense has some leverage to say, hey, y'all don't, you know, you weren't able to bring it home the first time. Mm-hmm. You might not be able to bring it home the second time. Let's meet in the middle somewhere. You know, give her 2 years in jail or something and call it good. I wonder if that was explored. I don't know.
Well, the consequences will be faced shortly, and that may be freedom, or it may be a lot longer behind bars.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.